KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th annual Pickathon, July 31st through August 2nd. Pickathon is 3 days and 7 stages of performances by a variety of bands such as Toon Yards, Shabazz Palaces, Ty Segall, Leon Bridges, Freakwater, and dozens more. Pickathon takes place at Pendarvis Farm in Happy Valley and features weekend or single-day tickets, as well as wooded camping, food trucks, and local beverages. A full list of artists, stage schedule, ticket prices, and transportation options can be found at KBOO.FM/Pickathon2015.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio on KBOO-FM. I'm your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Robert Whitaker. Robert Whitaker is a Pulitzer Prize finalist journalist. He is a winner of the George Polk Award for magazine writing. His previous book is Mad in America, and his new book is called Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. So thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio, Robert Whitaker.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your history of research around mental health and pharmaceutical companies and the treatment of people who are diagnosed with mental illness, and sort of what the background is. Where do you think we are as a society with how we respond to people who are in crisis and who end up with a diagnosis of schizophrenia or bipolar or any of the other severe mental illnesses?
I was a daily newspaper reporter for a long time, but then after I stopped being a daily newspaper reporter in the mid-90s, I went to the Boston Globe, who I'd written for before, to do a series on abuse of patients in psychiatric research settings. And this was going to be a fairly straightforward, story. And it was while I was doing that study, I came upon outcome studies that showed that schizophrenia patients in poor countries of the world, and this was done by the World Health Organization, and they did the study twice, fared much, much better in the poor countries of the world than in the rich countries of the world. And the World Health Organization actually concluded that living in a rich country of the world was, quote, a strong predictor that you would never fully recover. And I really then wrote Mad in America and got involved in this whole, field to try to figure out why did schizophrenia patients fare so poorly in the United States and in, European countries. And then those studies actually just led me into this larger field, this larger question, how do we treat people in this country who are diagnosed with severe mental illnesses? And, that takes you down an incredible path, an extraordinary path where nothing is as you thought it was.
What were some of the things that you discovered and kind of where are we now as a society in terms of mental health treatments?
Right. I think that those are related. I mean, in terms of what I discovered is that the story we had believed in as a country, the story I had written about as a reporter, and that story is that we were getting ever better at understanding the biological bases of different psychiatric disorders, and our drugs were getting ever better at treating those biological problems, ever more effective. That whole story is false. It just, in fact, researchers haven't been able to discover the biological causes of mental disorders. That's number one. And two, there's no evidence that, quote, the second generation of psychiatric drugs are really any better than the first generation of psychiatric drugs. And three, there's no good evidence that outcomes are getting better. In other words, during this whole era of the psychopharmacological revolution, you don't see mental illness becoming less of a problem. You don't see, outcomes, long-term outcomes actually for schizophrenia getting better. In fact, in 1994, Harvard researchers reported that outcomes were getting worse. And it's the same thing with bipolar. Bipolar outcomes are markedly worse than they were, 30 years ago.
So if the medications were actually helping, we would see something like with the introduction of penicillin, where the diseases that it treated actually went down dramatically. Whereas you're saying when the drugs were introduced for treating schizophrenia and bipolar, the results weren't evident. In fact, the situation got worse.
Yes. I mean, in any sort of big picture way, if you have effective treatments for a physical disease, the morbidity, as they say, and the mortality from that disease should abate somewhat, right? You should see people living longer. You should see people more enabled by those treatments. You should see the symptoms becoming less pronounced, all of those sort of improvements in outcomes. We do not see that with, if you go back and look at what was the spectrum of schizophrenia outcomes, say, from 1945 to 1954, just before the Thorazine was introduced, you see a very surprising picture. How much of a problem was bipolar disorder in 1965 before lithium became popularized? Well, A, it was quite rare, and there were very few people suffering from it, and B, those who did had generally pretty good long-term outcomes. Now it's a much worse course, a much more chronic illness. Same thing with depression. Depression didn't used to be such a disabling disease. So what we see now in this era of the psychopharmacological revolution, we see more people being disabled by mental illness, an astonishing increase in the number of people disabled by mental illness. We see people suffering from all sorts of physical problems that didn't used to characterize mental disorders. We see people dying 25 years earlier. We don't see nearly the employment rates we used to see. So what we see during this last 50 years since the arrival of Thorazine, during this era of the, quote, psychopharmacological revolution, we see outcomes for disorder after disorder getting worse. People are more chronically ill. We see they have physical problems. We see their employment rates dropping. We see early death. In other words, we do not see all of the signs in the scientific literature that tell of effective treatments for known diseases. It's just not there. Instead, what we see, and this is, goes back to your question of what I found and what is sort of became so gripping to me, is we see precisely the opposite. We see a tale, if you really dig into the scientific literature, that goes like this. We see a tale in which research has not been able to identify the biological causes of any mental disorder. That's number A. And B, we see drugs, if you actually look in the research in terms of how they work, that sort of perturb otherwise normal function. And C, we see poor long-term outcomes again and again and again. And bottom line is, it's a failed paradigm of care. And my new book, in essence, is that I'm working on now, looks at that. And here's just one example of the data you can pull up. In 1955, at the beginning of this revolution, there were about 570,000 people in state mental hospitals. But what we don't realize is many of those people were Alzheimer's patients. They were basically serving as nursing homes. And there were also people ill with end-stage dementia from syphilis. The number of people with mental disorders, schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, etc., was only about 360,000. By 1987, and I picked 1987 because that's sort of the beginning of the second generation of psychiatric drugs, but anyway, by 1987, we had something like 1.3 million people on SSI or SSDI because they were disabled by mental illness. And from 1987 to 2006, the number of people receiving SSI or SSDI because of a mental illness, and this is between the ages of 18 and 65, grew to something like 3.75 million people. So it tripled. Exactly the opposite you should be getting. And as you know, Will, we've been medicating kids now in the last 15, 20 years. Here's what's happened to the disability rates for kids who now can receive SSI if they're severely disabled by mental illness. In 1987, there were 18,000 such kids in the United States. Today, it's 600,000 such kids. The number is increasing by 100,000 kids per year. That's people 0 to 18 years old. And one other thing is, you are now seeing, if you look at the SSI and SSDI data, a whole new group of people appearing on it. And that is young kids, by this I mean kids, young adults, 18 to 25, showing up in great numbers, said to be disabled by bipolar illness or depression. They never used to be in the mental hospitals, that group of patients. They 20 years ago, they weren't showing up on the SSI and SSDI data. So suddenly, in this era when we began medicating kids left and right, we now have a new group of disabled people, young kids, age 18, 19, going right to SSI and SSDI. And you know what psychiatry says? Psychiatry says to those kids, and I'm sorry I'm using kids, but you know what I mean, young adults, you're going to be disabled for life. You're going to be chronically ill. I mean, it's just that those are all facts that tell of an absolute failed paradigm of care.
So you're saying that not only are people who are suffering actually getting any help from the basic treatments that are offered, but the treatments that are offered, which is primarily medication, is actually making the situation worse.
Yes, and what I'm talking about is in the aggregate, of course, because I know what's going to happen. People are going to call and say, well, I need my drugs. My drugs helped me. And it's absolutely true. A couple of things are true. If you look again at the scientific literature, there is clearly some evidence that some of the drugs alleviate symptoms that can be really problematic for people over the short term. That's true. Okay, and people perceive that. They're in a crisis or whatever, and maybe they're, you know, quite depressed, et cetera, and they get put on an antidepressant, and the depression, you know, lifts. There are people who, you know, in manic episodes that will get treated with a drug that will help break that manic episode. So that's true. Now, there's a second delusion, and there's a second problem that comes in. It's really sort of a delusional thing in the sense that a perceptual delusion. So you go on drugs, right? The drugs change you, and then you try to go off the drugs, and you often do relapse. But that relapse rate is greatly increased by the fact that the drugs have changed your brain, and that's one of the things that's hard to grapple with. And then finally, and this is what you just asked, do we see people in the aggregate becoming more chronically ill than if they were never treated with the medications? Answer, yes. And second, do we see people who are mildly ill, let's say you have a depression of some sort, then moving on to a worse illness, a worse category, say from depression to bipolar? Yes. And this actually is what's helping to fuel this bipolar boom. And that is if you use antidepressants with a great number of people, a certain percentage of those patients are going to have a sort of a psychotic or manic episode in response to the drug. Then they get diagnosed as bipolar, put on maybe lithium or a cocktail, and now they're really onto a path of chronic illness. So if you want to summarize the scientific literature, is there's some evidence for short-term efficacy. There's also evidence that once you're on the drugs, you're at pretty high risk of relapsing when you try to come off, especially if you do so abruptly. But three, the evidence is quite clear that over the long term, having been exposed to drugs and being put on these drugs increases the likelihood that you'll become chronically ill or ill with new and more severe symptoms. And that's what the story that is writ in the scientific literature. And it's consistent, and it you can find it from the moment we start this, basically, the first long-term studies in the 1960s, and it carries forward until today. It's an absolutely consistent picture.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio on KBOO-FM. We're speaking with Robert Whitaker, who is a Pulitzer finalist journalist. He is the winner of the George Polk Award for magazine writing, and his new book is called Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. So again, this is not any kind of argument to be completely blanket anti-medications for everybody or any kind of judgment of anybody who's taking medications and finding them helpful, because I certainly know plenty of people who feel very helped by their medications. This is really looking at the hard science and the long-term outcome of what, on the whole, these treatments are doing when they become the basic standard for treatment in our society, and the implications that people often don't realize when they get on the medications because they aren't really told the full picture about what the risks are with the medications.
Mm-hmm. In a way, what I'm talking about is societal perceptions. How does it working for us as a society as a whole? Well, it's not. because you're getting all this, you know, these increase in people disabled, right? And that's not what we as a society want. And then all you can say for the individual, you know, there are clearly a spectrum of outcomes of people exposed to the meds. And all you can say the science does is it increases the likelihood from that moment of first exposure that you'll become chronically ill or ill with new symptoms. But it doesn't mean that you might not also fall into, you know, a good outcomes category. And real quickly, there was this study done by Canada that's really fascinating that sort of points this duality out. And what happens there, at least at this time, is let's say you missed work 10 days in a row because you were depressed. Well, apparently, at least at this time, they had some sort of short-term disability that you went on. So what, and as you know, they have a National Health Service there, is so then they did the study where they looked at all the people who went on disability, short-term disability for depression. And then they looked at what percentage of those patients went on to long-term disability. And then they divided them into two groups, those who took drugs and those who never filled a prescription for antidepressants. Now, what they found was, and if I can remember this right, is that something like 82% of the drug-treated patients eventually went back to work, okay? Which seems, for that group, that the drugs worked, right? They got better enough to go back to work. That seems pretty high response. Well, what was the percentage of people who didn't take any drugs that went back to work? Well, I think it was 91%, if I remember this correctly. In other words, from societal's point of view, the exposure to drugs doubled the risk that a person would become disabled. Yet many people who took drugs will certainly see themselves as having been helped. And that's sort of the nuances sometimes of the scientific literature, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's absolutely a complicated issue, and it doesn't lend well to sound bites. That's one of the reasons that your work is so important, because you've dug into the studies and you've taken a really careful look at the science itself. Bob, tell us about the current situation, because there have been a number of scandals in the media that people have heard about. And what your sense of, you mentioned the corruption of the academic establishment and the pharmaceutical company's influence, the corruption of the science that's really driving the whole situation and that got us into the place that we're in right now.
What you really need is to be in a society where those who do the research are going to do honest research and are going to report the results honestly. In other words, so they do not have a bias. And then if you can do that, you can get information that allows people to make informed decisions. In other words, patients to make informed decisions, doctors to make informed decisions, and you can weigh the benefits and risks, right? And if we had that, I honestly believe the drugs could be used as tools in sort of thoughtful ways. But what's happened is that, in essence, the pharmaceutical industry, and this is particularly true in psychiatry, has basically bought all the top psychiatrists. And by that I mean is all the top psychiatrists are acting as consultants to the pharmaceutical companies. They sit on advisory boards. They get research grants, that sort of thing. And in fact, I went to the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting this past spring that was held in Washington, D.C., and the APA actually did a pretty nice job of saying how each of its speakers, you know, what was each of its speakers' relationship to pharmaceutical companies. And what you would find is they would be receiving money time and time again from like 5, 6, 7 pharmaceutical companies. And it wouldn't just be that they were getting research grants. They were on advisory boards. They were consultants, which meant they were committed. And these are the top guys at top academic schools. They are committed to telling a story to the public of how these drugs work and are good for you, because they're not going to be advisors and they're not going to be consultants and they're not going to be getting research grants if they're telling the public, oh, Christ, it looks like we're doing long-term harm with these drugs. And it was really fascinating, say, at the APA meeting. Up front, it was all like, oh, man, these drugs are so great. And, you know, there were press conferences for reporters. We're making progress treating depression, and we got these new thoughts about bipolar. And then you went to the big luncheon that was sponsored by one of the drug companies, and it said for juvenile bipolar, for example, you should be using a mood stabilizer and a neuroleptic, and if the first neuroleptic didn't work, throw in a second neuroleptic, and maybe you can use an antidepressant, right? So use drug cocktails, and that was the front story. Then meanwhile, you go into sort of the back rooms of the APA, and you've got somebody doing a long-term outcome study on bipolar, and he's saying, you know which group does best? Those off meds. You know which group did second best? Lithium only. Do you know which group did the worst? Those on drug cocktails, the very thing that's being promoted by the guys taking the consulting fees from the pharmaceutical companies. And that's where you see the corruption. And I'll give you another example. Again, this guy named Martin Harrell does this long-term outcome studies for schizophrenia. What does he find? 40% of those off drugs are recovered at 15 years. How many on drugs? 5%. Recovery rate is eightfold higher. Now, did the American Psychiatric Association announce that result? Did they put out a press release so that the New York Times put it on their science page, so that the Associated Press did? Absolutely not. They didn't put it on at all. That news didn't get out. It didn't appear in any American newspaper. And you can be darn sure that if the results were the opposite, that recovery rates were 40% for those on drugs and 5% for those off drugs, and recovery meant asymptomatic, working, et cetera, not hospitalized in the previous year, we would have heard about that everywhere in the newspapers, because that would have been a confirmation of the story. And that's what I mean about the problem with the corruption. It's not just that pharmaceutical companies pay guys at, say, Johns Hopkins or Harvard or wherever it be to design trials that then make their drugs look good. I mean, that's bad enough, and they do that. But in addition, the public doesn't even get told the real study results. The study results that tell a sort of long-term harm, they are absolutely covered up, buried, and not told to the public. That's really the corruption of the money. Now, a couple of examples. Fred Goodwin is a former director of the NIMH, and he's well known because he did the NPR's Infinite Mind series, I think is what it's talked about. And on the Infinite Mind series, he would, you know, basically promote the conventional wisdom. We're making progress, these drugs are essential, etc. Now, two things. What recently came out is he gets drug money. So, of course, he has to say that on NPR. Now, the other interesting thing is, at the APA meeting, he was at a session where the physicians were talking about how antidepressants had worsened the long-term course of bipolar illness. So away from the public, here's a guy among his colleagues who's saying, oh, Christ, this class of drugs is worsening the long-term course of bipolar. But publicly, when he's on NPR and he's getting money from drug companies, he's telling an only positive story, and that's a problem.
So he ends up being a marketing gatekeeper, basically censoring important information about the realities of medical treatment in the U.S.
Exactly.
All in the name of doing an NPR show that's all about helping people with mental illness.
So see how the public's being misled? If you go to a used car lot, right, or a car thing, and a salesman comes out, you know he's a salesman, right? You know he's going to try to sell you something. But what happens with the way the public gets its information about psychiatric drugs, they get it from academic guys, the guys that have titles like they work at Stanford or Johns Hopkins or Harvard or wherever it might be, former director of the NIMH, and you think you're getting the expert, the neutral expert. Well, in truth, you're getting guys that have signed marketing contracts with the pharma companies. That is, in essence, the bottom line truth, and that's the problem.
Tell us a little bit about what happened to Goodwin, because didn't he get exposed and then he was fired from NPR, right?
Well, he did. Now, the irony of this is, yes, he did get fired. And NPR said, oh, my goodness, we didn't know he was getting money. Well, I have to say, I can't imagine how NPR didn't know this. I mean, I knew it, and it wasn't like I was trying to find this out. So, I mean, it was easy to find out. So I don't know whether NPR was just embarrassed by the revelations or they truly didn't know. I'm surprised they thought that Goodwin, you know, was a virgin in this territory. I mean, it would have taken about 2 minutes to understand that he wasn't. There are virtually no virgins left in psychiatry. They are almost all on, you know, advisory boards, consultants, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a few, but there aren't many.
And so the story with Biederman of Massachusetts General Hospital?
Let's go back a few years. If you go back to the 1970s, 1980s, there was hardly anything said. There was people debated whether a kid could even get juvenile bipolar disorder, okay, whether it existed. So you might see kids having temper tantrums or acting out as, you know, behaving badly. But and so that's how, you know, it just wasn't seen as a mental disorder. Well, Biedermann became the guy that promoted the idea that certain kids did, in fact, a fair number of kids had juvenile bipolar disorder. And I think it's in 1995 he publishes a paper that helps establish this as a valid diagnosis. Well, what we see then in documents that have since surfaced in a lawsuit is that Biedermann was going to Janssen, for example, the maker of risperidone, which is one of the new atypicals, and he was saying to them, you give me money of a certain amount, and a fair amount, and what I promise to do is I promise to validate this diagnosis, and I promise to produce data that makes your drug looks good. So he literally was doing a quid pro quo, saying, fund me, and I will further your business interests. And there was even an element of extortion there in the letters he was sending to them or the emails, saying that if you don't do it, I'll go to one of the other drug companies that make an atypical antipsychotic. So just let's put this in a moral context, okay? He is going to say he's going to diagnose kids, some 5, 6 years old, with a disorder that never used to be diagnosed, and he's going to help get those kids on neuroleptics, antipsychotic drugs. And what do we know about those drugs? Well, we know they enlarge the basal ganglia, which is associated with an increased vulnerability to psychosis. We know that they often damage the basal ganglia, and that results in something called tardive dyskinesia, which is a form of permanent motor dysfunction. We also know that the drugs, the antipsychotics, shrink the frontal lobes, and that shrinkage is correlates with cognitive decrease in function. So we see that decline as well. So that's the moral dimension. You have a doctor at one of the top medical facilities in the country, MGH, Massachusetts General Hospital, saying to a drug company, I'll validate this diagnosis, we'll get more kids so diagnosed, we'll get more kids placed on the drugs, all you have to do is give me your money. And as he's doing that, we have data showing dysfunction in the basal ganglia over time. We're talking about permanent dysfunction. Dysfunction in the limbic system, which is the area that you do emotional responses to the world, frontal lobe dysfunction over time, and we're talking 5-10 years, but theoretically these kids are going to be on these drugs forever. So, I should ask you, Will, how do you, morally judge such an action? I know how I judge it. It's not what a doctor's supposed to be doing.
Bob, give us some contact information if people want to go to your website or get in touch with you. How would they do that?
MadInAmerica.com. That's all one word website-wise. So,
Robert Whitaker, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Will, thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert Whitaker. He is a Pulitzer Prize finalist and winner of the George Polk Award for magazine writing. His new book is called Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall, music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now the KBOO News at noon for July 6, 2015. The Oregon legislature this week will consider several bonds worth hundreds of millions of dollars affecting school safety, public transportation, and public works projects. Among the bonds being considered are $300 million for seismic upgrades to Oregon public schools, $45 million for transportation projects in the state, and $7.5 million to help develop Willamette Falls near Oregon City. A 2006 study showed that almost 1,000 public school buildings in the state of Oregon were categorized as having a very high risk of collapsing during an earthquake. Since the study was released in 2006, 34 out of the 1,000 high-risk public schools have been seismically upgraded at an average cost of $1 million per building. In national news, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service has released a report showing that polar bears may be largely extinct within the next 10 years. The U.S. Recovery Plan calls for several actions, including decreasing polar bear-human interactions, protecting critical habitat, and relocating polar bears to more remote areas. The Fish and Wildlife Service has admitted that these steps may slow the extinction rate of the polar bear, but only reversing global warming will save the polar bear in the long term. Polar bears in the U.S. territories have declined by more than 40% in the last decade. The United States women's soccer team defeated Japan on Sunday to win the Women's World Cup International Soccer Tournament. The U.S. became the first country to win the World's Cup three times. They also won the tournament in 1991 and 1999. In international news, on Sunday, Greece voted overwhelmingly to reject further austerity measures being pushed